When you pass a kidney stone, you very often get excruciating pain and you get, you know, bloody urine and everything else. Well, that's what they're going through right now. So we can't look at it and say, oh, the patient's dying, the patient's dying. No, it's a kidney stone to them. And they're regrouping.
You're listening to The Corbett Report.
Welcome back, friends. Welcome back to another edition of The Corbett Report. I'm your host, James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, here in late December of 2025, and it's towards the end of the year, and you don't want to hear about doom and gloom, so let's talk about a little bit of bright news on the horizon, or at least what could be the beginnings of a good news story. What you haven't heard yet? Well, you can take the news from headlines like these. LA Times op-ed: the left's climate panic is finally calming down. Intensity of climate dread is weakening. Elites giving up on the climate catastrophism hoax. And the climate cult's dissolution is inevitable. Bill Gates stepped away. Most nations offered only empty nods to climate targets as Bernie and AOC's climate gospel sidelined. And best of all, the COP is over, and it was a total disaster for the climate cultists. COP 30 roundup. Failure of a UN climate summit is great news for humanity, But it might not be over yet. Alert, end times? UK national emergency briefing wakes up world. 10 of the UK leading experts warn the world of impending climate change disaster scenarios that can no longer be ignored. A wartime footing is necessary. Yeah, there's some crazy stuff happening in the news right now. So joining us to discuss this news is previous Corbett Report guest and the author of The Great Reset, Global Elites and the Permanent Lockdown, is Mark Morano, who you'll remember from our previous conversations. I'll throw the link in the show notes in case you don't. Of course, he's at climatedepot.com, where I sourced those previous headlines. Mark Morano, thank you so much for joining us again today.
Hey, thank you, James. Happy to be here.
Excellent. Well, as people can tell from those headlines and maybe others that they've been seeing, there is some big, big change happening in the, at least the public perception of the climate hoax and hysteria. And I know that you are a regular annual attendee of the UNFCCC's annual COP summit. So you were there at COP 30 in Brazil. Tell us about that.
Well, first of all, it was one of the more out of the way places that I've ever been to a UN climate summit. Now, I've been to them in Bali, Indonesia, in Nairobi, Kenya, South Africa, South America. I'm trying to think if this was the most, this may have been just the most difficult, because you had to fly down to Brazil and then you had to take internal flights to this sort of rainforest jungle city called Belém. Oddly enough, it was the second time I'd been to Belém. I was there back exactly 23 years ago for a rainforest conference. And I had done the Amazon rainforest documentary, clear-cutting the myths about all the environmental, you know, if you remember, you used to have Sting's rainforest concerts and all that. And you had National Geographic and Hollywood and just X amount of football fields a minute. Well, I did a documentary, came out in 2000, 25 years ago, debunking that with environmentalists throwing down the US guidebooks. So I spent some time in both Manaus and Rio and Belém before. And this city that they had here was the most ill-prepared, I can say that with confidence, of all the 21 out of the last 23 I'd have attended. This was a city where local media reporting 80% of the residents didn't have access to adequate infrastructure, especially sewage and plumbing. And that'll be important later on, that'll be important shortly as I explain. But this city was just a disaster for a UN climate summit. It was true, not just poverty, but almost primitivism, if you can use that word. I guess that's a colonial word and that's considered racist now nowadays. But it was just, you know, infrastructure was completely crumbled, streets with holes, crumbling walls on sidewalks, stray dogs and cats, people laying in the streets, dirt, unpaved. And then you would go to the main strip in Belém and it would be like, you know, Galleria malls and nice restaurants and high rise and classy hotels. It was just, so there was all that going on. But essentially they brought in 50,000 people to the city that couldn't handle it. And it was a just disaster from day one. And just, you know, I'll get to the big picture in a second, but I just want to go through the logistics of it. They couldn't get you know, plumbing right. And they had a situation where world leaders didn't have access to any toilets at the UN summit for 6 hours. This is according to the Irish reporters and Irish media, but this is the day before I got there. And then they had massive problems with overflowing toilets, and to the point where they ended up restricting it with an announcement that people, all UN delegates and attendees, were no longer allowed to put toilet paper in the toilets at this 50,000 seat conference center. And by the way, the conference center itself was 88 football fields of Ringling Brothers, Barnum and Bailey tents. And it was just tent after tent after tent with no windows. And they were very poorly constructed. When it rained, you would hear it. The wind would move the tent, and you would also get lots of water inside. I called it indoor weather modification, and I did videos on that. You can go see it, you know, on my Twitter account, on X, or on my website. But it was just a disaster. So they had to go no toilet paper. They had major infrastructure problems. And this summit ultimately will be remembered as, first of all, it was the first time in COP history out of 30 Conference of Parties or UN Climate Summit meetings dating back to 1995. It was the first one with no official US delegation. So that was significant. And because of that, outlets like Newsweek and Politico declared that Donald Trump's decision not to send US delegation helped accelerate the collapse of this process and this climate summit, because it gave more weight and gravitas to the BRICS nations, Brazil, Russia, and other developing nations who are fossil fuel economies, who just asserted themselves without having to, you know, a lot of times a lot of countries would either defer to the U.S. or the U.S. would take up all the oxygen in the negotiations. Well, they just refused to sign on to this virtue signaling pledge at the end, which, by the way, the summit would have probably been declared a success if all the world leaders did what they do at every other summit and just say, we support a fossil fuel free world in the next, you know, by 2040. And then they all pat themselves on the back, successful summit, let's go to the next one. They couldn't even get that out of it. So the bottom line is, this was COP30. It was a disaster from the beginning. China took an unusual role in that they were the first pavilion when you walked in. They had Chinese flags. They had standing room only press conferences. They had books by Xi Jinping smiling. And it brings to life Donald Trump's 2002 X tweet, where he says the global warming hoax was invented to basically make the United States non-competitive in the world and make China the sole global superpower, which is exactly what the UN agenda has done, whether it's from EV mandates, the solar panels, the windmills. And China, you know, sort of played it close to the vest. They just sort of sit back as they build 2 coal plants a week, nearly 100 coal plants a year, and they supply most of the world's materials for EV batteries and solar plants and windmills. They just sort of enjoy this. Xi Jinping did not need to attend this, because he was already represented by the environmental action and all the ideologues and all the willing dupes of the, you know, European leaders who still go there and pledge fealty to this climate agenda. So the bottom line is, this was such a disaster, followed on the heels of last year's COP29, which I went to in Baku, Azerbaijan, a true oligarch if there ever was one. I remember I was filming cows in the streets, dirt streets, dire poverty, and then you would go 10 blocks over and you'd see Rolls Royce dealerships and, you know, the most unbelievable Gucci and all the jewelry stores and all the wealth. It was an incredible display. But at that conference, you had the oil minister of the host countries of Azerbaijan say that oil was a gift from God. And Al Gore and others got so angry, and that negotiation also broke down, where Al Gore is now pushing, after both COP29 and COP30, to not allow countries who dissent from the UN climate agenda to attend. Now, if they start banning countries, you're going to end up with an even further collapse process. But they're really upset. So to make a long story short, they've had 30 of these summits. Carbon dioxide has continued to go up in the atmosphere for all 30 of these summits. And nothing they've done has even slowed that rate. But they keep making the pledges that by 2040, by 2050, we're going to be fossil free. We're going to be net zero. We're achieving our goals. And they will not stop. So as it stands right now, the UN is, I would call it now, Robocop, because they've already announced next year's is going to be in a Turkish resort along the sea in Turkey, the next COP31. And COP32 is going to be in Africa, in Ethiopia, which ought to be interesting because I don't know about their infrastructure and their ability to handle 50,000, you know, UN people plucking in for 2 weeks like they do. But there are just a couple other examples here. They had the big metaphor was the fire that they had. They had a fire, as I mentioned, these were horribly constructed, just temporary tent structure. I don't even know the cause if they figured it out, but a fire broke out in one of the tents. And it literally looked life-threatening. No one actually got killed. Some people had smoke inhalation. But they had to shut down the entire conference for about half a day and clear that out and then close off sections from that. And it just was a PR disaster. It was a substantive disaster. And my favorite quote of the whole conference was Politico quoting a high-level UN official just saying, I don't even know what the F we're doing here, meaning like, why are we even here? These conferences essentially haven't achieved anything. But even the mainstream media, and you read some of the headlines from the LA Times to Newsweek to Politico to the New York Times, they were all just saying this was, you know, worthless COP. And I got to say, of all the summits I've been to, I've never been to one where it was just like, they can't get their act together. This was a absolute just shit show from beginning to end. One other point, they served in their food court. They had a UN scam going where you could only buy a food card. This was the first time in 20 years that I'd ever seen it. You had to buy a prepaid card. And then if you didn't use it all up, you then had to apply for the UN in this long process and they would refund you eventually, maybe back to your bank or your card. It was this big scam, another way for the UN to make money. But most significantly, they served meat at almost every single restaurant there. Steak, chicken, and burgers. Bob's Burgers, according to Politico, on day two of the conference, sold out of all their beef burgers. And that's just an example where the UN did an agriculture report saying cow emissions were more damaging to the planet than all the planes, trains, and automobiles combined. And then, of course, the delegates gobbled up all the hamburgers and they ran out on day two of the conference. They also had no hotel shortage in this small city of Belém in Brazil, relatively small. So they brought in cruise ships. And I mean, dozens of cruise ships along the river there for delegates and world leaders and journalists. I talked to many journalists who were staying, and these are like Carnival cruise lines. I mean, like the big ones. And if you look that up, the carbon footprint of these cruise ships are bigger than the airline fare and the hotel combined if you came other ways or stayed in a hotel. So it was just one of the worst. And I left out one of the biggest things was they had to put in a 8-mile highway. This was broken, exclusive story by the BBC. It was actually a press release from a Brazilian like infrastructure transportation office bragging that they were building this highway for the COP30, and they clear cut the rainforest. And the environmental minister, when he was quoted by the BBC for COP30, why are you clear cutting rainforest for a COP30? Well, we need to bring in as many people as possible. Why? So we can showcase to the world how we've been saving the rainforest. You can't make that kind of absurdity up. But that's it. So we actually went out to the actual clear cut trees and the new highway that was built and being built. And, you know, this upset a lot of environmentalists. Greenpeace was there talking all about saving the forest. So it embarrassed them so much at this conference that they came up with their new plan to save the rainforest. And you'll love this, James. The plan essentially is the developed world is going to pay poor countries to save their forests. A simpler plan, maybe just don't clear cut rainforest for UN, worthless UN climate summits.
You paint quite the vivid picture there of an absolute disaster from soup to nuts, start to finish. But suffice it to say, I guess Leonardo DiCaprio and Bono and others weren't jet setting in here for their PR campaigns?
No, there was not a single, now that you mentioned it, I don't believe a single Hollywood celebrity of any kind showed up. Now, previous ones, I interviewed Harrison Ford in Madrid. Greta used to be at all these. By the way, Greta, I in many ways respect her because Scotland 2002, which I can't do the math. I think it was like COP 27 or 28. I don't know. It was a year of interruption with COVID. So they didn't have one, but COVID lockdown. But Greta said she's going to stop going to these. She said the UN, the whole COP climate process, was a scam and that it was a nothing but greenwashing. And she just said it's a joke. So she stopped going. She turned against the UN, so much so that the year later, when I went to Sharm el Sheikh, England, Egypt, which was on the Red Sea resort. And that conference featured the new Greta, which they basically recruited. Remember, she was like the spokesman for the UN giving keynotes. Well, then they brought in this young blonde, and she was dubbed Hot Greta because she looked like a model and she wore skimpy outfits, and she became sort of the climate influencer for the young people. And Greta just disappeared. So Greta is no longer involved. There were no celebrities. Who did show up was Senator Whitehouse of Rhode Island, the Democrat senator. And you know what he spent his time doing? It was amazing. He just, first of all, he bashed Donald Trump. But interestingly enough, he complained that the State Department, for the first time in however many years he's been a senator, didn't pay his way down to the UN climate summit. And he went on and on about how he had to get outside funding and how the State Department wouldn't fund it. And this is outrageous. Basically, like, it's an outrageous use of tax dollars that they didn't pay his way. That was funny. And by the way, these aren't cheap. When I was in the U.S. Senate, I traveled to the State Department when I was with the U.S. Senate Environment Public Works. I went to Bali, Indonesia. I went to Kenya. My airline flight, it was business class, which is like equivalent to first class. I had lay down beds, the warm cookies, full meals. I had everything. It was incredible. Love traveling that way. Be $15,000 plus. I still have the receipts from the State Department just as a Senate staffer for me to go. So you can imagine the bills for U.S. senators. They probably don't go business class. They probably go the extra bump up to first class. So, you know, by Donald Trump saved the U.S. taxpayer probably in the neighborhood of $20,000 by not paying for Senator Whitehouse's trip. I think he's one of the only elected officials that were there from the U.S. Senate or Congress. Gavin Newsom showed up. Now, he was reportedly, according to DC Examiner, flew in on a private jet. I can't imagine any other way he would fly in. By the way, it took me 38 hours, just to give you an idea how difficult this was. 38 hours from Washington, D.C., Washington Dulles, to get finally to my destination in Baleen. This was during the big shutdown in Washington, too, so I had to sleep in the airport and, you know, fly the next day, and we had delays in the next airport. I mean, it was a mess. But Gavin Newsom showed up and just, you know, was preening for all the cameras and bashing Trump. He's trying to, of course, get the nomination. I'm convinced he's probably going to be the next president after Donald Trump. He'll probably be elected because we're in a yin yang situation in American politics. And I think, you know, we'll see where it goes, but he's positioning himself for that. But there was no AOC, no Bernie. What's interesting is if you look at the whole Donald Trump in his first 100 days, just decimated in a way that his first term couldn't even fathom the entire climate and energy agenda of the climate agenda. And there's with literally and virtually no pushback from anyone. I mean, I'm talking even climate activists, even Al Gore. Al Gore moved his activism overseas from the United States, doesn't even talk about it. Democrat senators were silent. Bernie Sanders, relatively quiet. AOC on this issue. You know, they're still active and powerful groups because they were active. They did push back heavily on Donald Trump's immigration agenda, you know, Democrat mayors, governors, but on climate, just crickets. So the UN comes and they felt this need. So Nancy Pelosi holds a press conference with other Democrats. Nancy Pelosi at one point said, oh yeah, and this is important. And Donald Trump is dismantling it and we got to fight it or whatever. She was just checking a box. And White House, you know, actually went for the first time, really showed any interest. But otherwise, there's just been no one cares. They realize they have to lay low. It's very similar to the transgender agenda, where there's really been no pushback to the dismantling of that. It's almost like they just realize they overreached and they're laying quiet. And that's the same thing with climate. So I don't think it's over. We'll get into the reasons of that separately. But the bottom line is Donald Trump, I have a lot of problems with Trump's presidency, mainly being I don't like the foreign policy. I think it's too neoconservative, number one. Number two, I think he's helping build a surveillance state with Palantir. This was a Bush-Cheney. I don't have to tell you this stuff, but I'm just giving you the bigger picture. Bush-Cheney tried this, was ruled unconstitutional, even Democrat senators were against it. So then they created Palantir. I think it was 2002, right when the Bush-Cheney stopped after they were trying to create a government surveillance state. So now Palantir has a contract, doesn't have the constitutional restrictions. I'm not big on Trump's AI agenda and the whole idea of, you know, us taxpayers subsidizing Bezos and Gates and all these Soviet-style buildings cropping up everywhere. And now you even have Fox News hosts saying, well, you don't even need a Christmas tree. Don't get a real Christmas tree because the data centers are encroaching on Christmas tree farms. Anyway, my point being, I can criticize many aspects of Trump's administration, but on the climate, energy, environment, he's exceeded. I'm in a group of climate activists, climate skeptic activists. We had like a top 10 list. Trump blew through that like in the first week of his presidency. He then blew past it to like 70, 80. I mean, items that we didn't even think were worth asking for because they were so far away, he was doing. And so the two things, I know I'm filibustering here, but the two things that are, a couple of things that are important, what can Trump do to make it permanent and is it actually dead? So those are the two things looming large, but I'll answer any other questions you have about COP30 or the state of the climate agenda, if you'd like.
Well, I definitely want to get to that because that is obviously an important part of this. But I think what you're gesturing towards is not just the failure of a singular COP conference, whatever. No, yeah. This is about a fundamental change in the narrative that's taken place. And I think the way that we can understand that perhaps best is something that happened right before COP30 that a certain climate activist named Bill Gates came out with a blog post that went viral called Three Tough Truths About Climate, What I Want Everyone at COP30 to Know, where it seems Mr. Gates has stepped away from, learned Dr. Bill Gates. Oh, wait, he isn't a doctor of anything?
What's he a doctor? Is that a
exactly. Step back from his climate catastrophism to say, you know what, actually rising temperatures aren't going to kill us all and we should be focusing on human outcomes. I think there are probably a number of self-interested reasons why Bill Gates is doing this, one of which is knowing which way the narrative winds are blowing and starting to get ahead of it and basically started a different narrative around this. I think another part of this is the AI data center monstrosities that are taking up more and more and more and more of the energy grid and realizing solar and wind isn't going to quite cut it for the AI data behemoth. But anyway, what's your take on Gates and what that signals about the way the narrative itself is changing?
Absolutely stunning. I mean, what's interesting about it is Bill Gates could have told you in year 2000, year 2010, 2020, that climate was not a catastrophe and that we should focus on human flourishing was the word he used. He actually said, quote, it's not a catastrophe. He could have told you all of that. He knew. He's not a dumb person. So it's not like, oh, there's some new science out. No, a couple of factors contributed. A, 30 years of failure, nothing. It's just all virtue signaling. One of the key things I understand about this, and we'll get to explain Bill Gates, is that this was very easy for both Republicans and Democrats in year 2006, when Al Gore's film came out, 2010 with Obama's cap and trade and all his EPA stuff subsequently. It was very easy through the teens for all the Democrat governors and mayors and all these, I'm going to support net zero and we're going to do, phase out fossil fuels. We're going to do EV, man. Everything just sounded great. Arnold Schwarzenegger was credited in 2005 with the California climate bill as being the savior of the climate. But he did nothing. All he did was commit stuff to regulatory that they wouldn't feel the effects of till many years after he's out of office. Well, what happened was, finally, all the chickens came home to roost. People were feeling it. You started feeling it, particularly like the gas-powered car ban and the EV mandate. That was going down like a hunk of concrete. No one could swallow that. So that of course was reversed, and it was reversed in actually a very good way, where the Republicans actually voted in Congress to reverse that and make it so it's not just an executive order or, an EPA or some administrative action. And what happened was the Russia's invasion of Ukraine, it laid it bare in Europe. So you had Europe widely abandoning net zero now. You had the Green New Deal halted in Europe. The EU elections last year went remarkably toward, climate skeptics and energy realists, people who aren't buying into net zero. The recent German elections were the same way. You had the farmers' rebellion beginning in the Netherlands, spreading throughout the EU, culminating with them throwing manure on the headquarters of the EU. So people are they were feeling it, they were connecting it. It was no longer a cheap virtue signal. So Bill Gates knew that was all coming. And then you have the election of Donald Trump. And one of the key things Donald Trump has done, and Lee Zeldin has done, even more so than Chris Wright, his energy secretary, but Lee Zeldin, the EPA chief, has done. And I didn't like Lee Zeldin. I didn't like the idea of him. I didn't know much about him, but I knew he had capitulated to, I think it was Showtime, to climate activists. He had in the past, changed his position and said, oh, climate's a problem. But as EPA secretary, He has reframed the entire narrative. He calls it a cult, a scam, and a religion. And he just goes after the media. He is strong. And it's amazing to watch. And he's the most, one of the most consequential members of the Trump cabinet. Maybe next to someone like RFK Jr. I know there's a lot of criticism saying RFK is not going far enough or he might be controlled opposition, but there's still been significant changes there as well. Those are two cabinet members I think are the most consequential so far, you know, outside of foreign policy. I mean, but anyway, so what Bill Gates is sizing all this up, keep in mind, right before he did this, CNN pollster said that you can go back to the 1980s and Americans' concern over climate change hasn't changed much. After trillions of dollars, all the kids indoctrinated, indoctrination of climate fears from kindergarten to college, all the public scares, Al Gore movies, all the media reports, all the linking every bad weather event. CNN pollster said there was no change in concern since the 1980s. And that's the key metric. Everyone's like, do you believe in global warming? Has the earth warmed? Do you believe? Meaningless. Are you afraid of it? Are you concerned? That's the number. And that really is, we're back to record low numbers that we were at before they even started the campaign. So Bill Gates is not a dumb man. Two reasons he did this. One of them, of course, was the election of Donald Trump and the reframing of the narrative. And Bill Gates is trying to suck up to power. And that's what he does. That's what pretty much all billionaires do, is suck up to power. And one of the things that Bill Gates recognizes, is the other thing he mentions, is the AI. Bill Gates is so terrified of lack of energy. And he's not he's a guy that can look at energy. He's trying to lease Three Mile Island. Mark Zuckerberg is trying to, both of them are either trying to lease or buy nuclear power plants just to power their AI ambitions. Larry Fink of BlackRock actually came out and said that solar and wind cannot even come close to powering, this was like last year, April of 2024, can't come close to powering AI. This is the guy who's now the operational head, the co-operational head after Klaus Schwab of the World Economic Forum. Larry Fink admitted this. So there's no way they can spin, virtue signal, lie, or come up with any modeling speculation about this. So Bill Gates, by saying this, particularly right before the conference, was a game changer. They went into this conference deflated. In fact, one of the only things of substance that Al Gore did was he attacked Bill Gates. I never thought in my life I would see Al Gore attacking Bill Gates. He said that Bill Gates, this is at COP30, Al Gore said Bill Gates was being bullied by Donald Trump and that he was essentially caving in and being, quote, silly. That was the phrase he used, silly, that Gates' comments on climate were silly. And that is a game changer. I never thought I would see it. What's next? Is Bloomberg or George Soros going to recant next? I don't know, but it's an amazing thing to watch. And never have we seen it this low. And I'm not even mentioning all the other aspects of this. The net zero bank collapsing, all of the whole ESG collapsing, all these climate pledges right before the summit. I think it was like over 80 nations didn't even bother to submit their climate pledges, which is sort of customary right before the UN conference. You know, the whole UN Paris Agreement is in tatters. 10 years after that, all the mainstream media was UN Paris Climate Pact, which was almost to this week 10 years ago, and I was there for that in Paris. They had wanted pictures of my face up, wanted for being a criminal de climate criminal, because we premiered our film Climate Hustle during the conference at a historic theater. We were shut down by the protesters. We had to have police come and have a police escort. And, we did a whole red carpet walk. But my point is, all the media is looking back 10 years ago, and they're basically saying it was a failure. And then the way they spin it is, well, at least it gave us the framework and we can move forward and it was an important step. But they're all admitting none of it came true. And this is 10 years later. Remember, we were told in 2015 that we've saved the planet. Obama, the French president, the UN Secretary General, all the world leaders were like, our grandchildren will look back and thank us for this historic day. And what happened? Within a year, they were talking about we had to save the planet all over again. So Bill Gates helped deflate it. And again, it's his own self-interest. He wants those AI. He wants our own. And this is, I'm viscerally opposed to this. Our own Pentagon and I guess its Energy Department is giving out $100 million contracts to big tech firms to build and subsidize these AI data plants. We're also doing the Republican version of the Green New Deal, if you want to say that. The Trump administration is doing guaranteed loans. Does that sound familiar? For nuclear power. Now, you could take the non-ideological Jack Kemp view, and he did this with welfare. He always say, like, to the extent he would point to, like, the Walter Williams view that, you know, the inner cities in the 1960s, welfare destroyed the Black family and churches, and it gave single motherhood. And then, of course, the poverty rate went up. So they would always say, to the extent, Jack Kemp was famous, to the extent that government should be involved, they need to be involved to the extent that they created the problem. So, yes, it's against sort of, and that's what I think the Trump administration is saying now with these loan guarantees to nuclear industry, which a lot, again, we're dealing with who has the best lobbyists, who has the best connections, you know, and so they're going to be giving out, you know, unsecured, guaranteed taxpayer loans to nuclear facilities on a limited basis. They're claiming only 10. You know, if this was a Democrat president doing this with solar or wind, you can imagine all the free market and conservatives howling, but there's not a peep out of it now. You know, I'm just telling you, that's some of the interesting things happening on the sideline there.
Yeah, well, as we have alluded to, I think, a couple of times in this conversation, it ain't over yet. We are not out of the woods on this climate agenda and the trillions of dollars of sunk costs that have been put into this scare over the decades. And one example of that I mentioned off the top, the UK National Emergency Briefing, that's waking up the world. We have to start a wartime footing. They're not giving up on this scam that easily. So how, first of all, how are they going to continue to press it, and how best can we counteract that?
Well, I think, and this is important, and again, I'm not telling you anything you don't know or your audience doesn't know, but COVID lockdowns were the game changer on climate. You can look at someone like Joe Rogan right before, I mean, in the years leading up, the COVID lockdowns. I remember he had Candace Owens on in like 2017, and she was telling him about climate skepticism. He's like, I don't agree with you at all. Let's go. Look, here's the NASA website. It says, you know, 97% of scientists agree. Joe Rogan was citing NASA to debunk a climate skeptic, right? Fast forward, Joe Rogan is like the biggest climate skeptic there is today. He has Bernie Sanders on. He's showing him the chart showing that we're at the record low temperature of the last, you know, half a million years or 500 million years or the lowest CO2 as well. And it's the same thing with Russell Brand, with Jimmy Dore, with all these progressives. I've talked to Naomi Wolf. I mean, all of these people, RFK Jr., when he announced for president, said, I'm not going to talk about climate. This was the guy who I interviewed in 2014 at the New York City Climate March. He wanted to jail the CEOs of energy companies. He wanted to punish skeptical politicians for expressing dissenting climate views from the UN and Al Gore. He announces in 23 when he was running for president, when he announced, he said, I'm not going to talk about climate during my campaign because it's been hijacked by the World Economic Forum and the United Nations for totalitarian control of society. End of story. So that's a big component of this, is these sort of, I guess you could call them honest liberals, classical liberals, or whatever. A lot of them have just turned on that whole movement. And a lot of people now, you could go to a public, you know, discussion and you, oh, well, all the experts agree. NASA said, no one buys it anymore. Thanks to Anthony Fauci, thanks to public health and what they did on COVID. So it made my job a lot easier. Now you ask me where they're going from here. The way they're looking at this, they're looking at Donald Trump in this current moment as sort of, he's a kidney stone that's very painful, but has to be passed through the system. When you pass a kidney stone, you very often get excruciating pain and you get, you know, bloody urine and everything else. Well, that's what they're going through right now. So we can't look at it and say, oh, the patient's dying, the patient's dying. No, it's a kidney stone to them. And they're regrouping. One of the things COVID lockdowns brought was the idea of morphing climate into public health. By doing this, they can bypass democracy completely, because even post-COVID, most states, other than places like Ron DeSantis's Florida and a couple other states, there hasn't been a lot of reforms to prevent, you know, the mandates and vaccine mandates and lockdowns and mask mandates we saw last time and stay-at-home orders and et cetera. There just isn't a lot of reforms. So the next pandemic scare, they're going to, you know, try all that again. Well, their idea is, starting, Australian researchers during COVID came out and said, let's add climate change as a cause of death to death certificates. As a cause of death. That's now in the peer-reviewed journal. Secondly, a group of Canadian doctors started actually diagnosing, and it was in Vancouver, the first medically diagnosed case of a patient suffering from climate change. Actually, the doctor actually put it on the diagnosis sheet at the hospital. And this is reported by the mainstream media. This isn't like dark web conspiracies and reporting. Everything I'm saying is like mainstream, either academic journal or corporate media. So they want to add it as a cause of death. And then you have the idea, Anthony Fauci had done multiple papers on this. Unchecked climate change leads to more viruses like COVID. We need to therefore regulate this. So the World Health and Dutiful Organization said that climate is one of the existential threats of the 21st century. And now we have hospitals considering climate change. They're talking about limits on water supply for surgeons scrubbing up for surgery. They're talking about limits on anesthesia. The American Cancer Society did a whole study fretting about the carbon footprint of cancer care. And it's unbelievable. If you look at what's going on in our medical care, doctors have climate toolkits that just began, and they're talking to patients about climate change and how they can, mitigate their own footprint and their eco anxiety. So I think that's one of the ways they're going to go forward, because it's very hard. They can never get a vote again. Like, we're going to have the vote in the United States Congress. Like, that's so old school. No one cares about that. You'd either do an executive order, you would do it through the EPA as they've done, or you would do it through public health. So the other thing is that this is what's happening. And the other reason, though, it's not over, aside from them turning it into a public health issue, is you have trillions of dollars. You have billionaires from Richard Branson, Soros, still Gates funding it. Gates' newfound skepticism doesn't mean he's not funding the research at Harvard University to block out the sun and geoengineer the climate. It doesn't mean that he's, it's still the number one farm, or at least, I don't know if he's still number one farmland owner, but NBC News had reported he's the single number one farmland owner in America, followed closely by China, followed closely by, Jeff Bezos, I believe, is really close on his heels too. All these billionaires buying up land, it goes in line with the whole equity asset thing and all the purchases of real estate, especially outside of, suburban or major cities where they're buying them all up. And Bill Gates has been pushing. He actually told the MIT Technology Review he wanted to stop everyone from eating actual meat. Instead, eat fake meat or lab-grown meat. The difference being, fake meat is the vegetable oil processed, like the Impossible Burger, which, by the way, is tanking, is now like millions in debt and maybe going under, which was a big Al Gore thing. So that's a good sign. People are rejecting the ultra-processed fake meat, vegetable oil. But also this lab-grown meat is frightening. So that's a whole nother thing. So you got all these billionaires funding it. You have the foundations funding it. The Associated Press gets millions every year. I think it's from either the Getty Foundation or the Tides Foundation to do a climate desk. You have academia. You have corporate media. You have all the corporations. You have the government and institutions from NASA and NOAA, even despite Trump, beside his budget cuts, which have been much more significant the second round. They're all still there. Everyone's still there. The UN is still there. America's signature is still on the dotted line of that 1992 Rio Earth Summit Treaty. And that was ratified by the US Senate. So just to morph into how we get out of this, the two things that Donald Trump needs to do, and the one I know he's on top of, and that's going after the CO2 endangerment finding. Just keep in mind that humans inhale oxygen, we exhale carbon dioxide. The CO2 endangerment finding was originally implemented by the Obama administration. And the idea was to regulate carbon dioxide, what humans exhale from our mouth, as a pollutant under the Clean Air Act, which never mentioned carbon dioxide. So they retroactively did it, and it's been regulated like that. Now, Trump administration first term stopped, but then Biden started it again. Trump stopped this time. What they're trying to do now is, and they're going to announce this in January, I'm told, Lee Zeldin. I was at a luncheon with EPA officials 2 weeks ago in Washington. There's going to be a big announcement on this in January into February. They're going to have the legal team trying to make this. They're going to try to reverse the entire frame, the legal basis for this. And it's going to eventually, hopefully, go back to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court will rule that you cannot regulate carbon dioxide as a pollutant without a legislative act of Congress. This can't be done through basically judicial fiat and reinterpreting the original Clean Air Act, from the 1970s and then the revision in the 1990s. So that's a big one. If Trump can get rid of that, that's the basis for a lot of our EV and solar and wind and climate goals, and states and localities use it. Well, we have the endangerment finding. We have to regulate carbon dioxide as a pollutant. And that's another way to link it to public health, by the way. If it's a pollutant, pollution is bad for public health, and therefore carbon dioxide can be regulated. And the second thing is, and this is what my message in COP 30 was, and I was very excited because I said this live on Fox and Friends. I did 4 Fox News hits that week from COP 30. The first one was the most significant because Donald Trump on Truth Social posted my entire segment. And in that segment, I mentioned to him, Mr. President, you need to go after this 1992 treaty that Republican President George H.W. Bush got us into, the Rio Earth Summit Treaty. This brought in sustainable development. It brought in Agenda 21. It brought in the UN climate process, which then later led to the UN Paris Agreement. It brought in net zero. Everything began. We need to vacate that treaty. And I quote in my report, you have not only mainstream media, but legal experts basically saying, if a president vacates a treaty like that, it's going to take a new signing of the treaty and potentially, depending on legal interpretations, and these are like economists, you can get a bunch of different opinions, but it looks very likely. And the environmental left and climate activists are worried and the mainstream media is worried. So that's a good sign. You'd have to get it re-ratified by the Senate, which I think in today's environment would be virtually impossible. So I said to him in my best Ronald Reagan voice, Mr. President, tear up this treaty from 1992. And he actually posted it. So I'm hoping this message, because I have not, there's been a couple officials early on that alluded to it, but there doesn't seem to be any movement. He needs to get on this immediately because there's going to be, we need to get started with a legal challenge and we need to make this stick because yin, yang, Obama, Trump, Biden, Trump, back and forth with climate and energy policy is not good for anyone. And those two things, vacating the UN climate treaty, I'm sorry, the UN Rio Earth Summit Treaty from 1992 and abolishing the CO2 endangerment finding where governments can regulate carbon dioxide as a pollutant without an act of Congress based on a Supreme Court interpretation that, you know, we can just say, oh, CO2 is a pollutant. That is what if we can do those two steps, there can be a certain level of permanence to help us against a future president, AOC or Gavin Newsom. And I will bet you, I feel very strongly that Gavin Newsom will be either the next president or a president within 8 years. I mean, I just don't think America had a huge realignment that everyone thinks of. I think Donald Trump has, because of his personality and because of maybe some overreach and because of his non-populist agenda, has damaged his brand enough that he's going to be, you know, he only has maybe like 6 more months before the midterm campaigning kicks in. And then, of course, you're going to have, I think, a Democrat win in the midterms. And then Trump's going to be, you know, pretty much stymied from any more congressional action. So now is the time. And I really think they need to do those two things to make this semi-permanent. Because the first term, with Trump's first term, as great as it was, nothing compared to what he did this time, was undone within like 2 months of Biden being president. That's how quickly you can undo that stuff. And just they reversed course on all the policies.
You know, Mark, it's so gratifying to see that I think we have independently come to the exact same conclusions on all of this. For people who want more on that 1992 Rio Earth Summit and its centrality to this issue, they can see my How and Why Big Oil Conquered the World documentary, where I talk about Maurice Strong and the UNEP and how that played such an important building block in the narrative that we are currently seeing deconstructed or reconstructed before our very eyes. Secondarily, yeah, the health issue. I've been ringing the bell about this for a few years now. The key words, One Health, is the new agenda that they're trying to push. Yes. And that's the key words they're using at the WHO and the UN to try to bring all of this under one big umbrella that they can regulate everything in the world, including you and everything you supposedly own and all the rest. So I think, yeah, those are two incredibly important parts of this. And yes, Mr. President, if you're watching the Corbett Report, rip up that treaty. Excellent. And I think I'd have other things to say to the president besides. But besides that, I mean, there's, first of all, just to the climate skeptics out there who have held their ground for all these decades, give yourselves a big pat on the back. And yes, thankfully, we are starting to see the public waking up to the hoax and seeing through what has really happened here. But it ain't over yet, and there's more to come. So I know that I will be keeping an eye on it through outlets like, of course, Climate Depot. It's such a valuable resource for that. Why don't you tell people a little bit about the work that you do and how people can stay tuned to the latest developments?
Yeah, my website's climatedepot.com. I'm on X. I'm at Climate Depot. And I cover this daily, and I'm going to be meeting with the Trump administration again in January, and I'll be giving updates. I'm also going for a week, the third week in January. I'm going to Davos to the World Economic Forum, uncredentialed. I'll try to get a credential. I don't think it's going to be possible, but I'm going either way. We're doing an alternative climate Great Reset event at that. And I believe Donald Trump will be attending as well. Not ours, but I mean, in Davos, but we're going to have an alternative event right outside of Davos. And I will be running around the streets seeing who I can get in Davos. They may be shutting down any non-friendly reporters, but we'll see. And I think, you know, we go forward on this. I'll be covering all this at Climate Depot. So thank you so much, James, for the time and opportunity to talk to you and your audience.
Well, thank you for the updates. And thank you for a little good news cheer towards the end of the year here. Yes. I do appreciate it. Mark, let's not leave it so long till the next time. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you, James. Appreciate it.
Computer whiz kid.
Part of your genius is that you are a computer whiz.
Cutthroat businessman.
The U.S. Justice Department contended that the software giant had breached antitrust laws.
Selfless philanthropist.
Bill, even your harshest critic would have to admit that your philanthropy work is planet-shaking, incredible.
Ruthless eugenicist.
But that's called the death panel, and you're not supposed to have that discussion.
As more and more of our world is coming to rely on Bill Gates for his guidance.
One of the best informed voices is that of businessman and philanthropist Bill Gates.
It is time to ask what really lies behind Gates' quest for control.
Things won't go back to truly normal until we have a vaccine that we've gotten out to basically the entire world.
It is time to ask, who is Bill Gates? Watch the complete documentary for free at corbettreport.com/gates or support the work and purchase a DVD copy at corbettreport.com/shop.